are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore with Orla Chinoui.
Hello.
Orla, last month we were in Marseille and on the top of the Col d'Izoard, but we're back in the more familiar...
Be careful.
More familiar surroundings.
We're in my garden, so don't do it down.
No. And we're doing a bold new experiment this month, aren't we?
We are. We're hopefully recording this for YouTube as well, just for something a bit different. I say hopefully because I'm in charge of the technology, and Richard, you can see what it looks like. It's two iPhones precariously plugged into an extension lead in my garden. So I'm hoping that it works. If it does, then you'll be able to find this episode on YouTube as well and let us know what you think. And if it doesn't work...
You won't.
Just ignore me.
You won't.
Richard usually does.
I won't. I don't know. Well, what have we got in this month's show? We've got three distinct parts, as per usual.
Sorry, I'm looking at you funny because I thought you were throwing that to me and I thought I wasn't paying attention when you told me what we were doing.
When we were planning and stuff. It's got off to a bad start already, actually, because when you offered me a coffee... You asked if I wanted instant coffee.
No, I said, do you want an espresso or do you want a powdered coffee? The reason being, I'm quite partial to a powdered coffee because you can sneak an extra spoonful or two of coffee
in there. Disgusting coffee.
But you get an extra kick or three,
horrible,
like that.
Horrible.
Anyway, you got an espresso. Stop moaning. It's like a flat white.
Anyway, it's not. And it wasn't that hot either. But anyway, last month we were talking about La Course, obviously. Our sort of response and enthusiasm for La Course changed over the course of the episode. We'll no doubt talk about it again because it's a big talking point. We're hoping to get some more reaction to it at some point as well from certain high-profile riders, but keep that quiet for just now. But there has been some more racing since then. There was the Ride London Classic the week after La Course, and then at weekend just past Crescent Vargarda in Sweden, the team time trial on the Friday, and then the road race on the Sunday. Very unusual team time trial, but nice little rehearsal for the World Championships coming up soon. Part two, we're going to do a little feature in part two on female director sportifs. That follows the feature that we did in the Women's Tour episode a couple of months ago when you and I spent the day in team cars. You were with Kanya Schramm, I was with Team WNT, and a few listeners got in touch to ask whether there were many, if any, female sports directors working. So we tracked down a couple of them and we'll hear from them. We'll also hear from a real pioneer, Robin Morton, who you interviewed, Orla. And in the final part, we'll hear from Molly Weaver, the British rider who rides for Team Sunweb. And she's had a torrid time with injury, terrible, life-threatening crash, and has battled back only to fall off again at La Course. So I interviewed her there. Hannah Troop had interviewed her earlier as she was recovering. So packed as usual, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. The DS thing, I think, is going to be really interesting, and I'm really looking forward to hearing from the ones that you interviewed, because the UCI have started a scholarship scheme, haven't they? They started it last year to try to encourage women to go into that side of the sport. Full scholarship is paid. It's a once-a-year course. It's now obligatory for men's cycling. It's not obligatory if you want to be a DS in the women's side of it, though. And I just find it really interesting as to why there are so few. And we'll talk about that when we come to it.
Don't ruin it all now.
I know.
I don't want to peek too soon. There's lots to say about that. What about the racing since La Course? Have you seen much of it? I think you watched Ride London, didn't you?
So yeah, we had Ride London Classic, as it should be pronounced, because they go with a French spelling, bizarrely.
You could say the same about the cycling podcast, Femina.
Very true, but that was your inspiration, yeah. Corin Rivera, the winner there, in a rainy, wet all day in London. We haven't had much luck with the weather, really, in London. But the biggest prize fund, of course, in women's cycling, €100,000 all up. Katie Archibald got one of the intermediate sprints and
has retired.
Yeah. Well, she's retired rich relatively for the women's peloton.
That's what I meant.
€1,000 she got for an intermediate sprint, which is almost as much as you get for the entire 10-stage Giro Rossa winner, which just goes to show how much really needs to still be done in terms of prize funds. But, you know, it's great that Ride London do offer parity with the men when it comes to...
Well, it's funny though, because Molly Weaver, who I mentioned earlier, is obviously Con Rivera's teammate. I bumped into her at Marseille Airport. She was flying to Holland, I think, on her way to London, and she was riding Ride London and really looking forward to it just for that reason alone.
For the
it
money.
It was potentially a big payday. Well, it was a big payday in the end for them, obviously.
Yeah, €25,000 went to Corinne Rivera, which will obviously be shared out among the rest of the team. And a brilliant second place as well for Lotta Lopisto. She did a fantastic manoeuvre on the final bend. If anybody watched it, you'll still be able to see it online. She gained a couple of places with a really bold move on the inside. It was fantastic racing. But Rivera, who again has had a wonderful season, said that she was just able to bide her time, really. That you can see the finish line from a long way out. So it's about patience and not panicking as much as anything else. Probably fair to say she was the only rider who had a decent lead out as well, which makes the world of difference. But yeah, brilliant win for Corinne Rivera and a fantastic second place for Lotta Lopisto, who we're going to be talking about as well when it comes to the Swedish races.
I like how you've positioned us here, Orla, in our little studio in the garden so that I'm looking into the sun.
In my defence, was sitting in that spot. Because of you and your dodgy hip, you wanted this spot that was the best supported.
Okay, so...
can never win with you.
So actually, one race I forgot to mention at the start was the European Road Race Championship as well, which was recent. And I watched a bit of that. Marianne Vos won it. She's back. She struggled a bit La Course, but she's been coming back from the injury she suffered at the Women's Tour, of course. And she won that. And it's one of the only things she hasn't won. It's a pretty new title anyway. Anna van der Breggen wore the European Champions jersey for last year. So Marianne Vos is in that now. I think we'll get used to it, the European Champions jersey.
I hope so.
You're grimacing a bit.
Well, it's still not... I don't particularly like it as a design, really. I'm sure that doesn't take away from Marianne Vos' pride at wearing it.
Why not just blue with yellow stars?
Yeah, it'd be much nicer. It just feels a little bit of a cheapo design.
It does look a bit cheapo,
doesn't it?
Yeah.
But Marianne Vos, delighted to be wearing it.
I'm sure she'll be happy to be wearing it, nonetheless.
I saw some of Cassie Nowidoma's Instagram stories, and she Instagrammed from, I think it was from Sweden, it must have been, with Marianne wearing the jersey and doing a little dance on the bus, and obviously delighted to have that added to your palmarès, because we do tend to talk about Marianne these days more in terms of what she has achieved and hoping...
Fading force.
Well, I mean, it's cruel, though. It's horrible, but...
I only say that because we described Andre Greipel on the Cycling Podcast as a fading force a few years ago, and cue an incredible resurgence. So having
so
said
maybe
that,
doing her a favour.
She's going to have an incredible couple of seasons now. She's probably going to win the World Championship.
She could do.
She could do. Yeah. She looks very, very good. And she was second on Sunday as well in the World Tour race in Sweden, Crescent Vargarda, to Lotta Lopisto, who you mentioned earlier. But before that, there was a team time trial, which, as I said, is a very unusual thing to have for trade teams. There are only two, that and the World Championship, which is coming up, of course, in Norway soon. So it was a good dress rehearsal for that. And we had a man there at the team time trial.
Our man on the ground.
Our man, Jonathan Rowe, who does lots of things for the podcast. He produces episodes. He runs our friends scheme.
He bullied us into recording this for YouTube.
He did. He does lots and lots of things. He also drives the Rafa mobile cafe around Europe, and he ended up in Sweden. So there he was with his recording device, and he spoke to some of the people there. I think we'll hear from Bob Varney, from Anna van der Breggen. Anna van der Breggen first. It sounds like they're walking alongside a horse, in fact. It's just... it's her cleated cycling shoes, right. We can hear. And we hear from Hannah Barnes as well, so let's hear from them now.
No, it's special to have a team time trial here because it's nowhere else a race as a team time trial. So this is for our team also important. We see it as a race on its own, but also as a preparation for the Worlds, for the team time trial championship. So an important day and an important time trial for us. Oh, it's totally something different than a normal race and also than a normal time trial. You only see a team today, and that's not a good thing. They make me suffer, and that's of course that's the purpose of a team time trial. It's a high intensity when you're on front, and then you have to try to recover in the wheel, and that goes well if you ride smooth as a team. And that's pretty difficult here on this circuit because it's going up and down.
Yeah, hi, I'm Bob Varney from Drops. I wouldn't say we're new to it, but we're probably newer to it than a lot of the teams. It's the first time we'll have got our Trek Speed concept bikes together for all six riders. So we're really excited and very proud of that. We did some team time trial work every year, last year in Mallorca and again this year in Mallorca, which we think will be beneficial. I think our riders are naturally quite adept at riding close to a wheel. They're all good bike handlers. They all trust each other. We've done a couple of specific sessions. We did one yesterday. So, yeah, although we're not going to be up there on the podium, we're hoping to give it a real good go.
For me, I get the most nervous for a team time trial. It's just such a team event, and you don't want to let your team down. You know it's going to hurt like crazy. It's good. I think it's a really beautiful thing to watch as well if you do it right. Yeah, and I think we're pretty smooth out there today, so you can be happy. This course is ideal for preparation for the world. It's quite similar, so it's similar in length and also the terrain as well. For me, I'd love to go. I mean, we have Lizzie on the team. I know she's pretty up for it this year, so we can actually go into it with a really strong team to support her there. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I love Norway. I've got family there. My mum and dad have booked the flights and everything in January, I think, so they're really looking forward to it too. It's kind of takes them back. They had the honeymoon there, so for any chance they get to go to Norway, they go. And yeah, I'll probably have my sister there as well, so yeah, it's kind of a family affair really.
Okay, so we heard there from Anna van der Breggen, Hannah Barnes and Bob Varney. As Bob suggested, his team Drops, pretty new for them, and they were 16th on the day. I'm not sure. We're going to get Bob to join us in a future podcast, so maybe hear a bit more about that. It's such a technical event, though, and Jonathan also spoke to Danny Stamm, who we didn't hear from there, runs the Bulls Dolmans team. He said they went out a couple of days before just for team time trial training. It is a discipline where practice doesn't make perfect, but it certainly makes you a lot better. It's highly, highly technical. The riders enjoy it. People, cycling fans, are kind of divided on team time trialing, whether they enjoy it or not, but it has a place. And, you know, that was, as I said, an interesting rehearsal for the World Championships. Bulls Dolmans were the winners, as they were at the Worlds last year.
And as they were at this event last year as well.
Indeed. Cervelo Bigla were second, Kanya Schramm were third. They swapped places at the Worlds last year. So Kanya Schramm have an excellent record in this event, in their former guises as well. It was pretty close, 12 seconds just separating Cervelo Bigla and Bulls Dolmans. That very good for Cervelo Bigla, I think.
Yeah, and as you say, dropped 16th out of 21. There were 21 teams in all of that. And I think it'll be quite a welcome win for Bulls Dolmans ahead of the World Championships. They were so dominant all throughout the season last year. And I actually just went through yesterday and had a little look at every win so far this season. I suspected that they were down slightly, which they are. They had 17 World Tour wins at this stage last year out of 36-ish. 11 this time round. So,
and most of them, I think, Anna van der Breggen, no? I mean, last year, yeah, the wins were spread throughout the team, whereas this year, I think the majority of those wins will have gone to Anna van der Breggen.
Yeah, and she stays in the purple jersey, of course,
and,
for the
World
Tour leader.
She's just joined the team, so she wasn't there last year. So you have to look at the riders, Megan Garnier especially.
Lizzie
Deignan has ridden pretty well, but the highlight of her season probably winning in Yorkshire, I think. She's obviously in pretty good form. She looked very good at La Course. Maybe the Worlds will fall her way again.
Yeah, they could well do. And I think that to an extent, it's to be welcomed, really, for non-Bulls Dolmans riders and staff and fans that there is a little bit more of an even spread for the wins this year. And it does, I think, point to maybe a raising of the game elsewhere. I mean, the likes of the riders that we're talking about, Corin Rivera, for example, has just been fantastic for Sunweb. Cassinovia Doma, Lotto Lapista as
who
well, with a few podiums.
Joining, transfer news, joining Canyon Sram next year, Cassinovia Doma.
Yes, indeed. But I think that it just feels like there's more dynamism to the racing and the results certainly this year compared to last year. It felt a little bit inevitable for certain races that Bulls Dolmans would win it with any one of a number of riders. As you say, this year, Anna van der Breggen, the outstanding standout winner for that team. But yeah, so that'll be welcome for them. And in such a technical discipline as the team time trial, that's surely going to bode well going into the World Championships.
And the road race on Sunday, Crescent Vargarda or Vargarda road race.
You know, you didn't change your pronunciation, you just lowered your voice.
Well, I was inspired by Jonathan. I heard him pronounce it. I thought he did a pretty good job. Lotto Lapisto was the winner in that very stylish Finnish national road race champion jersey. Cool name as well, isn't it, Lotto Lapisto?
Yeah, we like that. Yeah. You say you struggle with her name, though. It's really, really easy.
Yeah, no, I don't struggle with it in that sense. I struggle to remember what order the vowels go in. There's a lot of vowels to think about. But I'm there now.
I'm trying to count the vowels now. There aren't that many.
There are quite a few.
Five between...
I was going to say about the race. It was an interesting race. We'll hear in part two from one of the DSs we speak to about the difference between men's and women's racing. In men's racing, always following a similar pattern of a break going and being gradually reeled in, and how we don't always necessarily see that in women's racing, but in that race we did. We saw a big break, 11 riders and most of the top teams represented, you know, and then have it chased back, which doesn't always happen. Sometimes when all the teams are represented like that, it actually sticks. It was brought back because there were a couple of teams missing. And it was an interesting race tactically because there were a lot of strong riders up there, including Alexis Ryan, our diarist from Tour of California. And yeah, it was quite an interesting race. It's beautiful countryside. I mean, the landscape is spectacular there. It could be a more challenging finish, I think. You've got the gravel road sections and things like that as well. The last couple of years, this year especially, it's come down to a pretty big bunch sprint. There were about 35 odd riders there, and it was a pretty big bunch sprint in the end. But yeah, a great race to watch. The scenery, as I said, absolutely majestic.
And a great win for... Now I'm struggling.
Come on.
Le Pistot. I actually confused between the O and the A. Anyway, she came second last year and she's had injury this season, so she missed quite a decent chunk after the Spring Classics. Did really well in the spring. Two podiums, I think it was. So a good return to form for her. You said the gravel section you found a little bit underwhelming though, did you?
Yeah, much was made of the gravel sections and I struggled to really notice when they were on the gravel section. It wasn't exactly Paris-Roubaix. Mm. But, you know, I mean, it's nice to see the race going off the beaten track, as it were. I mean, we love that at Strade Bianche. There's rumours of Tour de France next year going off-road up in Brittany, perhaps. Dirt roads, dust roads. Fantastic. You know, I think we want more of that.
Yeah, and it does lead to different style of racing as well, I guess. The last couple of years, this race has been won and by the breakaway, it's managed to stick and stay away. So this year, the fact that we had a bit more of a sprint finish means that they can mix it up a little bit. And to go back as well to the point I made about there being ever-increasing professionalism, I guess, in the women's peloton. At the end of the race, Le Pistot had said how last year, when she came second, she was kind of on her knees, really, because she'd spent the entire race in the breakaway. And this year, she was protected for the entire race. So she didn't really, she said, have to do much of an effort, make much of an effort throughout the race. She was able to save her legs for the sprint. So great team tactics there by Cervelo Bigo.
They were. Ashley Moulman-Passio actually was very active up the climb, not far off the finish. We saw Lizzie Dagnan have a go there as well. I spent the day with the Cervelo Bigo team a month or so ago in London with their director, Thomas Campagna, who's quite a character, and Ashley Moulman was there and several of the other riders, Cecilie Uttrup-Ludwig, I believe her name
very
is.
Good, very good.
It's a very difficult name to pronounce, that one. She's the leading, or she was, I'm not sure if she still is, the leading under 23 rider in the Women's World Tour, and a great talent. We'll maybe hear some of those interviews in a future episode.
The cycling podcast Femina is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport, who sponsor the cycling podcast Femina, as indeed they do the cycling podcast. Very grateful indeed to them. There is a discount available for podcast listeners or podcast viewers now. If you go to scienceandsport.com at the checkout, enter the discount code CPAUG20, that's CPAUG20, you will get a whole 20% off all your Science and Sport products, which is well worth doing. So, Orla, I mentioned that after the feature that we did a couple of months ago at the Women's Tour, I was with Graham Hurd. You were with Barry Austin, weren't you, from Canyon SRAM? Yeah. Graham Hurd is the sports director at WNT Racing. And a few listeners got in touch to ask the reasonable question of whether there are any female sports directors working in women's racing. And the answer is there are, but not that many.
Not that many as DSs, and I'm struggling to think. Not that many through the sport as a whole.
Well, there's one that I know of only who works in men's cycling as well, Rachel Heal. We'll hear from her. God, I'm struggling to just speak today.
It's always an occupational hazard.
That's difficult. Must have been that coffee that you gave me. So, subpar coffee. It hasn't quite got my engine revving.
You needed the extra scoop, you see. Oh,
obviously I did. Anyway, we'll hear from her. It is a bit of a tongue twister, that, though, isn't it?
What? We'll hear from her.
Rachel Heal, we'll hear from her.
Not really. It's not really up there with Peter Piper, is it?
No. Lotta La Pista, though. Anyway, we'll hear from her. We'll hear from Donna Ray Zielinski, who works for Wiggle High Five. And we'll also hear a little bit from Robin Morton, who is a real pioneer because she worked for a men's team in Italy, an American woman. Quite a strange story about how that came about. We'll hear more from her in a future episode.
She didn't just work for them, she co-owned the team. And that was back in the early 1980s. She was a total trailblazer. Brilliant to chat to her about what that was like back in the day. And I do find it still fairly curious that there are so few women in either side of the sport. In men's cycling, certainly, which, you know, this is a women's cycling podcast, but we're talking about women in the sport in general. I'm certainly very aware of being a woman even now when I go to races. There are much more of us than there used to be, but it's still an environment that is very dominated by men. And when we listen to Robin chatting about the Giro, not necessarily right now, but the Giro in particular is a race that is just so macho. It's just from another era. I mean, when I've covered it from start to finish, I remember there's this one fellow journalist, an Italian journalist, who used to sniff the air behind me when I walked through the press pen. I mean, it's that kind of very bizarre sort of the face you're pulling right now, Richard, is very disconcerting. But it's still an environment whereby you're very conscious of being a woman. And like I say, less so in the women's side of the sport, but it is strange. you've got me. That was maybe not the best anecdote. Anyway, now I've lost my train of thought. Anyway, so, yes, there are still so few, even in the women's side of it. And it is curious as to why.
Well, it is and isn't, I think. And Donna Ray...
Well, I was trying to explain why there were so few, because it's still a very much male environment.
When you think about it, Donna Ray Zielinski said this, that there are more ex-professional male riders looking for jobs in cycling. Mm. And I think that's why a lot of them end up in women's cycling. Not end up in women's cycling, but you go to the women's racing and the team cars are generally full of men rather than women. She said practically as well, you know, a lot of women at the age where they might become sports directors are becoming mothers, and it's a very difficult thing to combine. One that she did herself successfully because she wanted to. Well, we'll hear her talk about that. But there are practical reasons, I think, why there are far fewer females working in that particular job than men. But there's no reason at all, you know, from a skills point of view, why they couldn't. And one of the sports directors I spoke to thought that actually the breakthrough would come in men's cycling, that he could imagine there being more women working as sports directors in men's cycling than in women's cycling, which is perhaps counterintuitive, but why not?
Yeah, and the UCI is doing its bit to try to encourage the change. They are offering full scholarships. They have done for the last 2 years now. This is the second year, to any woman who want to undertake their DS courses in Eglin, Switzerland. I think it's just a couple of days at the end of November. And the courses are now obligatory if you want to be a DS in the men's side of the sport, but not yet in the women's, which I think would be probably quite welcome if that were to change, that there was that level of professionalism as well in the women's side of the sport. But they are doing their bit to try to encourage at least women to enter into it.
Well, Donna Ray Zielinski and Rachel Heal both did that course last year. Donna is actually running the course this year. I asked her why there was a separate course for DSs working women's cycling, we should say, rather than for female DSs. And she said, well, the rules are different between men's and women's racing. So that makes sense. But should we hear a little bit from Robin Morton, the trailblazer we mentioned? As I said, we will hear the full interview in a future episode, perhaps themed on trailblazers and pioneers. But here's a little bit from her about what she thinks about the situation now.
I feel like I accomplished a lot. I don't know if I forged a path. I don't know how many people have actually followed, you know, my crazy idea. I think that women's cycling hasn't actually come far enough. I'm surprised that there aren't more women involved on the men's side of the sport. There are women, you know, physical therapists and women trainers, but there are really no women with the exception of Rachel Heal. And that isn't a full-time job for her on the men's side. But with the exception of Rachel, I really don't know anybody else that is directing a men's professional team. So in that regard, I think women's racing in terms of the level of competition and the number of teams and with the Women's World Tour, I mean, I think that's fabulous and it's come a long way, but I still think that women haven't made enough inroads on the men's side of the sport. I think women tend to be more consensus builders, you know, and I think that that's important. Often the directors, I find, are very autocratic. And I think that the teams now, the writers, want to have more say into certain aspects, not necessarily the selection of the events or who is selected to be at a specific event. But I think that in general, the writers have a bigger say in what goes on with the teams now than they used to. It's not such a dictatorial kind of environment. And I think that women are generally better consensus builders than men. But yeah, it was a different experience. I can remember at one point, you know, in the morning before the stage start, Rancilio, who was an espresso machine and espresso maker, they had their trailer that came there, and all of the team captains would go in there every morning before the start of the stages to kind of just sit around and, you know, shoot the breeze and have an espresso before the start. And so one morning, they had invited me in there and said, well, kind of one of the guys now, and we want you to come in and sit down and have an espresso with us. So I went in there, and it was like Moser and Vincentini and Fignon and, you know, Roger de Vlaminck and all these riders that I was really in awe of. And so we're sitting there, and they said, well, you know, now we think you're like one of the guys, and we have something that we want to give you. And I'm thinking, okay, this is great. It's going to be like a signed Malia Rosa or some kind of Giro memorabilia. And they came out with a tray of vegetables in the shape of male genitalia and presented me with, like, you know, eggplants and all kinds of weird things. So, but they did have a photographer there, so it was totally a setup. But yeah.
So that was Robin Morton, and we will hear the full interview because, you know, we were going to include it in this episode, but I just felt that there was so much detail there. It's such a great story. And there are great stories from that period in particular in the 80s where there was a weird moment where, on the one hand, women's cycling was developing quite quickly then. That development then slowed down again. But in the 80s, it seemed to be, you know, with Jenny Longo, Maria Cannons, and the Tour de France Femina coming along, there seemed to be quite a lot happening on the women's side of the sport, but then that slowed down. But for women in the men's side of the sport, it was still very, very difficult. And there were, you know, one or two people who came and worked in it, Robin Morton being one, Shelley Versus being another at 7-Eleven, who encountered serious hurdles. And it's fascinating. It sounds like, well, I was going to say, it sounds like stories from another century. It is another century, You know, it's staggering how different the environment was. That you're saying it's bad now, Orla, but it was a different age.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even say it's bad now. I think to note positivity or negativity is a bit irrelevant, really.
Well, you're a very positive person, aren't you?
I'm a very positive nature. Person. Yeah. But glass half full. But it's still very stark, I would say. I do think it's sad that Robin didn't end up being the trailblazer, I guess, that she could have been. Nothing to do with her, but more the woman who came behind, that they didn't see that then as something that they could do. And maybe it just would have taken such a cultural shift that we probably are kind of maybe in the middle of. I mean, for me personally, I was thinking to myself whenever I heard about the scholarships, I'm always thinking, what else can I do with my life? And I thought, oh, maybe I could apply to be a DS. Why not? And then I thought, could I really work in an environment that is so male, if it was to go into the male side of it? With the woman side of it, I think it's much more friendly in that sense. But it's still a long way off, I think.
How about your driving skills?
Have I not mentioned that I'm a fully qualified racing driver, Richard?
Oh, yeah, I forgot about
Richard.
That. I forgot about that. But you're not allowed to use your phone. You're driving, you know that.
Well, you're allowed to.
Actually, you are.
You're allowed
it's
to. Well, exactly.
It's
exactly.
Seems you're allowed to be compulsory.
Hang on. So as a DS, you're not only allowed to use your phone, but it's expected. You can kind of get away with watching TV as well. You're allowed to chat to
everybody
around you.
I'm not sure if all
you.
These things are technically actually allowed.
No, so maybe
that
I wouldn't get onto the course.
It helps if you're able
to do everything while driving at the same time. So I'm perfect candidate.
Anyway, you mentioned that Robin Morton wasn't a trailblazer, but she was in a sense, and somebody that she mentioned was Rachel Heal. Let's hear from her now. She is a sports director for United Healthcare in the US. They've got a men's and a women's team. She works for both, mainly with the women's team, but also for the men's team. She's worked at Milan San Remo with the men's team. And interesting story. Let's hear from Rachel Heal. Then we'll hear from Donna Ray-Zielinski, who is a sports director for Wiggle High Five.
to me, it's about the best person for the job. And that may be unusual for me to say that I'm not like, yes, we must have all staff as women. If the women are better, then yes, I think, you know, they should have the jobs. But I also don't think that they should have a job over a guy that's better just because they are female. Maybe a little controversial view for a women's sport director to have, but I would like to feel that I have my job because of the job that I do, not because of being female. I think because there are so few of us, maybe it's not something that people think about. You know, within any sport, I guess you look at kids and kids are looking up to heroes and you know, I guess sports figures they want to emulate. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, I think countries have been so keen to get, you know, women athletes as role models, because then kids look up and it's like, okay, I want to do that. And maybe it's, you know, it's the kind of grown-up version of that, is that women don't see so many sports directors, you know, female sports directors, so they don't think so much about, that's a job I'd like to do. In terms of I guess, work, I went straight from rider to director. And I was in what I decided was going to be my last year of racing. I was lucky that I got to the point where I was getting older and slower and decided that it was time to stop racing. And my director at the time was moving back to Jamaica and was looking for somebody to take over the team. And so myself and one of the other riders both retired at the end of the year and stepped into directing the team. And we directed together that first year and then carried on my own after that. I've probably worked more with male sports directors and had got on better with male sports directors. Although this last year, working with Iona as a female sports director, she was great. And I think for me, the male-female thing didn't particularly come into it. Before my life in cycling, I was an engineer, so I was in a very male-dominated environment there, so it's not something that ever really fazed me or I particularly thought about. For me, it was this is a job I'd like to do, and the fact that there weren't many women doing it, well, I was used to that, so it wasn't a big deal. The first race, I did a couple of races, shadowing one of our men's directors, and then there's more of the men's races where you have two sport directors. In the majority of the women's race, there'll just be one, but more of the men's races, there are two. So the first race I did as a director with the men was Coppi Bartoli in Italy. Yeah, so I was working with Roberto Damiani over there. So the men's race, there are two cars. So I'm driving car two, and being in the caravan is not daunting. I'd been doing that for many years. But Italian roads and Italian men's pelotons are a little different to pelotons in the US. There's a lot more riders and the roads are an awful lot smaller. So that side of it, the driving side of it was a little bit nerve-wracking and challenging, because, you know, I think for anybody trying to pass a peloton of 200 riders on a road that's about 4 yards wide is a little bit of a daunting challenge. I still very clearly remember hearing over race radio that, you know, the numbers of riders in the break, and realizing that, you know, we have a rider, Davide Frattini, is in the break, and there's the initial elation from the sport director point of view of, great, we've got a rider in the break. And then that realization that means I have to go up to the break. That means I have to, you know, and I think this was the first stage. So it's literally, you know, 30 minutes into my first race driving car within a men's race. And it's like, yeah, I have to figure out how to pass these 200 riders. In that same race in Italy, the Coppi Bartoli, the final stage was a circuit race. And then you only have, you just have one car. So Roberto decided, well, okay, today you're sports director one. I will be your guest in the passenger seat and you're driving. There were quite a few of the other sport directors that would, you know, drive past, or I would drive past them. And I could see them doing a double take when they realized that it was me driving the car. So I mean, Italy is probably one of the most, you know, traditional countries, and maybe one that would be least expecting to have a woman as a sport director. I would imagine within Italy, there are probably very, very few. The men's races are still follow more of a script than the women's do. Yeah, within a team meeting before a men's race, you can say, okay, this rider, your job is to get in the early break, because you know there will be an early break. And maybe it'll go in the first 200 metres, maybe it'll take an hour, but there will always be a break. Within women's races, that isn't always the case. You know, the races are a little bit shorter. You know, in a lot of races, it can be more full gas from the gun, and maybe a break will go and maybe it won't. But in terms of the, you know, what makes a good sports director, you have to be organised. Yeah, so it's a combination of being organised, being able to read a race, and the biggest thing, I think, is being able to get the best out of your athletes. As long as you're doing your job properly, it doesn't matter to them whether I'm male or female.
It's awesome that, you know, we have, in my instance, Rochelle, who is willing to back a female DS. You are seeing more. You have the UCI now offering scholarships for women to do the DS course. So it is growing. I was fortunate, I am fortunate to have an incredibly supportive husband and a supportive workforce. Like, there are a lot of parents that would take care of my sons for me while we were at a track session, or, you know, I've followed road races with a child in a restraint holding a bottle. You know, I'm holding the bottle in the child's mouth while I'm driving. You know, things like that. You know, it comes down to seeing things as a problem that's too big to overcome, or finding ways to work your passion. You know, for the men to go into DSing, it's a viable career path financially, whereas, you know, it's only starting to grow as that for females. But, you know, again, is there a glass ceiling? In my opinion, possibly there is, but you can either look at it and say, yeah, it's too hard, or you can, again, as I've said, pursue your passion. I love sport. I love helping people achieve their goals. And to me, I just found a way, because it's what I wanted to do. I'd rather do that than something I wasn't as passionate about. I think that people should get the job on merit rather than gender. But to me, it would be nice to have more women represented as DSs in the Women's World Tour, yes. Nothing against any of the men that are there already. Yeah, but of course it would be nice. And I think, you know, it's a good question to put to the women's teams. You know, what are your thoughts on having a male DS versus a female DS? It's like, it's not a competition. It's just different needs are met in different ways. When a pro tour team goes to the Tour de France, I'm told they have 4 DSs at the race, and they each do different areas of responsibility. We have 1 DS at a course, and probably, you know, the biggest thing for being a DS, you have to be multi-talented. It's everything. It's logistics, it's people management, it's, you know, the tactics. It's not just one thing. We do it all. I mean, I would love to be at a point like they have in the men's race, where they have a TV in the team car and they can actually see the front of the race. We tend to see the back of the peloton, and depending on your spot in the convoy, you might not even see that. I had to take one of our riders into the car during La Course. She wasn't well, and so she couldn't complete the race. And at the end, she said to me, she goes, "Oh my God, I would never want to be a DS. That's just too hard." Yeah, look, it's intense, but it's my favorite time. I love when you're in the car, the race starts, and it's like you're in a cocoon. It's your own little world where you're in contact with the riders and you're oblivious to the outside world. Yeah, look, it certainly can be hairy in terms of the driving and things like that, but you actually don't think about that, because every minute, you know, you're thinking about what's happening in the race, or you're going past bunches. I just love it.
So we heard there from Rachel Heal and Donna Ray Zielinski, both sports directors, Rachel for United Healthcare and Donna for Wiggle High Five. And there are others. I mean, Beth Durea at Canyon SRAM is involved on the organisational side with the team, but also acts as a sports director at times as well.
Yeah, and one of the things that struck me actually when listening to those interviews was that when And we often hear it from women when they said that they'd like to see more women doing the role of DS, but that it, on merit, so that it wasn't just for their gender. And what strikes me every time is I have never heard a man say, I would like to be chosen on merit rather than my gender. And I always
but
think...
But it's not so much an issue,
but,
is it?
No, I know. But so the thing is, we don't really actually mean on merit. What we tend to mean by that is that the woman has to be at least ever so slightly better than the man to kind of compensate for the fact that she's a woman. I think we need to stop saying that it's on merit and just assume it that
should,
that's the
well,
case.
Well, yeah, we should. I don't think we look at a woman in a team car and wonder whether she's there on merit or not. You assume that she is.
Do we, though?
I don't think so, no. Do we? No.
I think we kind of do. And I think, well, I think I'm probably tying myself up in knots now. I think we should assume that they're there on merit. And we do. And what I mean is that we need to just stop saying that. And then that way that women stop limiting themselves when it comes to putting themselves forward.
I think
forward.
We are tying ourselves in knots. Yeah. But I asked both Donna and Rachel whether there was a difference between men's and women's racing. And Donna said no. And Rachel said yes. And I guess the other question is there a difference between male and female bike riders? And on the one hand, they are all bike riders, but I often wondered at British Cycling, for example, British Cycling obviously have a male and female program, lots of male and female riders, but in the coaching staff, no females at all. I don't think there's ever been a female on the coaching staff at British Cycling. There may be now, actually, but certainly over the sort of period of success they've had, there haven't been any female coaches. And I have sometimes wondered whether... You know, a female coach might be a better coach to a female athlete.
I think sometimes it can be a better coach to a female athlete and a male athlete.
Or a male athlete.
And sometimes you need the male perspective. And I think the point is that, yeah, they are all bike racers, but we are different. We're very different as genders, I think. We have different set outlooks on things and different approaches to things, good and bad. And I think that to make a balanced world, to make a balanced peloton, to make a balanced team and a balanced rider, you need input from both, really. So it's not whether the female touch is better than the male, it's having both of those together, because sometimes a woman's approach will work in a certain circumstance and sometimes the man's approach will work in a certain circumstance. And obviously then every woman is different and every man is different. We're being massively generalistic, but I think you need a bit of both, really.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our main sponsor. They are fantastic backers for us and the cycling podcast. And we've been joined on the sofa by a t-shirt, the Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt. This is part of the range of clothing that they launched just before the Tour de France. Rafa, designed and made by Rafa. They are launching... Sorry, Orly, you look like you're going to say something.
I was just going to praise Rafa for finally making a t-shirt that looks like it would fit a professional cyclist, because for a few years, you boys were handing out tents, basically.
We were handing out t-shirts.
You were handing out Pride.
Made for normal people.
Yes, but these are clearly made for cyclists.
Little
cologne bottles.
But they get them in my size as well, which is nice. Anyway, this is a Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt that we've got here. They are selling very fast and they are making more. But
yes, you can buy them.
They're launching a new range of t-shirts for women. I think jerseys as well. Pedaleurs de Charme with a slightly new design, tweaked for the females.
So I hesitate.
Female sizes as well.
Ask what symbols are on the Pedaleurs de Charme. We've got an eau de cologne, we've got a comb and a sponge.
Wait and see.
We don't have lipstick and heels, do we?
No, voila. Anyway, they'll be available soon. Stay tuned to find out when they'll be for sale. The gear that is for sale is at rafa.cc or through our website, thecyclingpodcast.com. If you click on shop, it'll take you to the Rafa Cycling Podcast clothing. So do go and have a look. And as I say, the Pedaleurs de Charme stuff will be available soon. It's being made as we speak. Well, it's being designed and then made. you can have a look at that. In this final part, Orla, we are going to hear from Molly Weaver, a young British rider who has had terrible misfortune, but through it all has kept smiling, amazingly. Hannah Troop interviewed her a few months ago, just when she was recovering from her terrible smash with a car, which left her with numerous horrific injuries. We'll hear the whole sort of catalogue of them in this interview. But it was amazing listening to her, just how optimistic and upbeat she sounded. despite all that, and at a time when it wasn't even clear that she'd be able to come back. So let's hear from her, and then I caught up with her at La Course. She had suffered another nasty crash on the first stage of La Course, but she was still pretty happy with it all.
I was going to say, because we were waiting at the top of the Col d'Izoard for Molly to arrive. We'd done our interviews with winners, also-rans and notable extras, and we were waiting for Molly to get up there because you wanted to catch up with her following Hannah's interview to see how she was getting back to racing. And then we hear that she's crashed again, and my heart just broke for her.
It was a nasty one. I remember seeing the rider on the road, not realising it was her. It was a nasty crash, so she was quite badly bashed up. But anyway, let's hear from her before and after, as it were. Here she is talking to Hannah Troop and then to me in Marseille.
I don't remember being on my bike for 1 second. I've actually ridden past where it happened. Yeah, most days actually now, and still I have no memory of it whatsoever. I've been told what they think happened, but I think that's all we'll ever know, really. I do remember waking up, and I remember going out on my bike, so I knew where I was going that ride, but I didn't even know where I'd crashed within that. And I actually don't really remember the next 2 days, really. I remember waking up, and then there was someone with me. Then the next thing I remember, my dad was there, but he didn't actually arrive for 2 days, so I don't know where that went.
I take it you were out on your own that day, were you?
Yeah, it was just like an easy, just like 1 hour ride or something, just a spin. I was travelling the next day to training camp, so it was just meant to be a little bimbo, spin my legs. And then I was actually descending, but I was on a straight bit of road, and the car hit me head on. And what they think happened is that he was driving too fast, and he'd just taken a corner, a right-hand corner, and he'd just come out wide from the corner and then hit me, yeah.
Did the guy stop?
Yeah, he stopped, and apparently he was also in a bit of a state. But yeah, he stopped straight away and called the emergency services. But I was unconscious for over 3 hours, so actually I don't remember any of this, obviously. But then luckily here it's a big cycling community, and actually stupidly I had no idea on me or anything, but the fireman knew someone and the ambulance man knew someone, and the word got out pretty quickly. Yeah, you've got your kit on, you've got your name on your bike, so they think, okay, she's British, she's got matching kit, so she's probably a pro. So then they rang actually the bike shop here, and luckily the owner there speaks Catalan and English, so then she came and she could translate a bit and help me out in those first bits when I first woke up.
Yeah, because that's the problem as well, isn't it? If you're in another country, don't have a high enough level of the language, those moments are quite frightening as well.
Yeah, definitely. You wake up, and actually I do remember the sort of half an hour in waking up, and obviously it's very disorientating and you don't know what's going on. So yeah, just having like a familiar face. And also, I don't speak any Catalan, really, if I'm honest. So, she could translate, and that it makes it a lot easier. But also, there's people who can ring your family, because my family live back in Britain, and try and fill them in on what's happening.
So when you got to hospital, and after you come around and everything, what were the extent of the injuries that you had?
At first, actually, they told me completely different things. But once we'd had tests and stuff, I broke my neck, 5 vertebrae, 4 ribs, my sternum and my shoulder, and punctured my lung and tore an organ, I think my kidney.
Obviously, when you kind of get told that, to try and understand or try and process that, what kind of were the first few hours, days like in hospital for you?
The first few days, weirdly, were almost easier. I was a bit out of it. I think it's harder on your family then and people who care about you, because actually, I was so in and out of being aware that really, they tell you stuff and you don't really process it. So they say you've broken your back and you're like, oh, okay, like you don't have any real motion around it. It's more as you start to recover a little bit and it moves away from just, I'm alive, can I walk, all those basic things. Then it becomes more difficult as you realise what's actually happened. Actually, probably about 3 days into being there, they came and it was time to have a sponge bath, which was lovely. And I speak none of the language, and I didn't have a brace on at this point, a back brace. And I'm trying to tell the guy, like, don't move me, I've broken my back, I've broken my neck, don't touch me. And he was just going, oh, it's okay. And most painful experience of my life, because you can't communicate with them. And then 2 days later, he came in and I was in the full brace. And I think he realized he kind of messed up in that moment. And actually breaking, the most painful one, now it's my back and neck is more of a problem, but the most painful breaks actually was my sternum. So any movement was agony. So I was like, nobody touch me.
How were your family when they came over? That must have been the times super hard for them to see you like that.
Yeah, actually only my dad came. He got a phone call, but at first it was obviously horrific anyway, but at first I was still unconscious when he got told, so it was obviously the worst case scenario. Kind of, he got rung and it was, your daughter's been hit by a car and she's unconscious still and we don't know the extent of the injuries and et cetera, et cetera. And then we didn't really know until he got here, but my mum decided not to come because she's the more emotional of the pairing. And I think they thought practical was the best way to go. Yeah, she definitely wanted to come, but I think also when they sat down and discussed it, obviously they had to book flights and things, so it took them a couple of days. I think, yeah, they knew in that situation it's better to have someone who's not going to be fussing over you and emotional and crying about it. You want someone who's going to, yeah, just be practical with it and be straight with it. And it's because obviously, especially at first, I wasn't that emotional with it, and I think if someone had been sort of fussing, it would have been more difficult actually to sort of get on with it, get out of bed, get moving, and they'd be a bit too protective almost.
When you got back home after being in a week in hospital, what was that like? How did you find that going back? Were you on your own then, or did you still have your dad around?
No, he stayed for another week and a half, 2 weeks, because I couldn't really do anything. I was out of hospital, but I wasn't that able to fend for myself. I couldn't really move that much. I mainly could just sit, and actually the night was the worst because I couldn't really lie down, so I had to sit in a chair, but it became very uncomfortable. And we bonded a lot because I also couldn't do things like shower myself. So obviously you can imagine you have to get quite close quite quickly in that situation.
So then as kind of like the weeks have gone by, how did you kind of deal with everything?
I think, yeah, probably the first week that I was at home was the hardest emotionally. The racing started and I did tell myself, oh, you're not going to care. Like, just, you've put yourself out of it and it's fine. You've sort of already dealt with it. And I sort of kidded myself that you'd already processed it and I'm absolutely fine. I'm going to be fine with it. And yeah, even my dad was like, oh, it's okay to be upset about it. It's okay to be emotional. But I really did think, oh no, I've already put it behind me and I've already moved on. But actually, I will admit that first race, I did just cry the whole way through it. It was, my team obviously won, which is amazing, but that was really difficult. And yeah, I think the first part was almost, obviously, then you're unable to even, you know, walk properly, do anything for yourself normally. So it's very frustrating and mentally really difficult. But once you start to see little bits of progress, you almost have to put yourself completely back to step one. Don't think about anything you've lost or you're missing or what you could do, and it starts to be okay, just a bit of progress each day, and then that's then, yeah, much easier, you focus on that.
There's such a massive community in Girona. How did you find that they've helped you? Or
it's been amazing. A lot of people have said, oh, is it not difficult to be surrounded by it? Would not have been easier to go home or be somewhere else and not have it so much in your face all the time? But actually it's made me feel much less isolated in it, because I think one of the things is you go from, you know, you go into training camps and races and you're always with your team and you're with the riders. And I think if you then completely separated yourself from that, I think very quickly you'd feel very out of the community, out of it, and very isolated in that. So I think it's been a good thing to feel still feel a part of cycling and a part of the racing, even though I can't be there.
Because you've obviously got back on the bike now. How's it felt going back out onto the roads?
The first few rides, I was definitely more nervous. Actually, I didn't ride on my own for the first couple of weeks. I wasn't as loose on my bike and comfortable, and I wasn't in as much control, so it was good to have someone there. But also just, yeah, emotionally for me, I just found myself being much more nervous and much more cautious. I think that's still the case. I think, you know, it can be in a positive way. Sometimes you are a bit stupid on a bike. I think we all are. You know, this was completely not my fault, I'm sure. You know, most accidents are 100% not the rider's fault. I think a lot of times you take little risks, you know, you jump through a little gap, you turn with, you know, going a bit quick, or you're doing, and actually that's the only thing where I thought, okay, you know, that's a bit stupid of me to do that. And so I am a bit more nervous, but I think the fact that I have no memory of it, that's more of a something that's happened since in thinking about it, rather than an actual, you know, side effect of the crash itself. I think, yeah, especially in the early parts of the recovery, I was very much in a more angry place with it, dwelling on it. You know, you think, you know, why me and why has this happened and it's not fair. And it's, but actually, you know, this event happened and I can't change that. So from the moment it happened, yeah, everything for me is now different to how I planned it. And it was obviously a massive setback for me and, you know, an awful thing in my life. But you think, well, it's happened now. I can't change that. Nothing can change that. Nothing can bring back what I had before and whatever. So now you can just focus on, okay, every day, making every day the best it can be and doing the best you can to come back and to get back to your life. And I think that's all you can do, really.
Great to see you racing again.
Yeah.
we caught up with you just after the crash when you hadn't returned to racing. You rode the Giro Rosa. Yeah. How was that? What was it like being back racing?
Yeah, it's amazing to be back racing, but it's a bit of a double-edged sword. I think it's great to be back in the peloton and be physically able to race, but on the other hand, yeah, you feel like you trained so hard over winter and then again after the accident and you're still not on the level you would hope, so you're actually just really suffering as well. So it's a bit of a mixed feeling, but yeah, it's great to be back in the peloton with the girls, also with my team. It's nice.
So you felt like you were starting again almost, but then you've come to La Course and you're in quite a bad way, unfortunately. You had a crash.
Yes, again, that's also a bit mixed, because actually in the start of the race I even said to the girls and said to my DS, I actually feel really good. I feel the first time like I'm really back in the peloton, I'm comfortable in the wheels, and also, yeah, actually I feel really strong today. So then for me that's a really big positive. Then to crash, yeah, it's part of racing. It's, yeah, again, some more bad luck and it's not good, but I also think that hopefully I should be okay from it. I've already trained the past 2 days and I've actually felt okay. So
cycling is easier than walking, because you look quite stiff. You look quite bashed up. What happened?
Yeah, it was just one of those, yeah, bad timing things in racing. There was a gap on the right of the peloton and I went to move past my teammate, and that exact same moment two other riders also went into the gap on the right, and then one of you crashes normally and I was a little bit further back, so yeah, my front wheel went and then, yeah, went over the handlebars and then tumbled. But I've got some road rash, but apart from that, I hope it's just that clears up and then I'm okay. Yeah.
After what you've been through, you must have feared the worst to hit the deck again.
Yeah, the initial impact always, yeah, is the scary moment when you take a second and think, okay, what have I done? My wrist was a bit sore and I cut my face again. And I thought, oh God, no, I already cut my chin open last year and I thought I did that again. So, yeah, but then once you take a moment and breathe, and actually, yeah, it could have been a lot worse.
So you're back on the bike already. What have you made of La Course as an observer of today's time trial chase?
Yeah, I think actually the first day up the Isoard, I think that was a really good step. I think it was great on the Champs-Élysées. It was also a big stage, but it's nice to see them still investing in something new and changing it. And that was, yeah, a really, really exciting stage for us. This was a bit of a weird one. You don't normally see something like this. We all actually said that the format of it could have been really exciting. I think maybe they made some errors in the time gaps and things. I think if it had been really close at the front, then I think it could have been really exciting, whereas kind of Annemiek van Vleuten is one of the best time trialists and she had a lead of 43 seconds. So I think, yeah, then it's maybe not as exciting as it could have been. So
yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because it's unusual for someone who's such a good climber to also be a very good time trialist, but she has this set of skills. I was going to ask, you're part of Team Sunweb. Obviously, there's the men's team as well. How much are the two teams integrated? Do you have a lot of contact with the men's team?
Yeah, it's actually, I think, one of the few examples where it really is one team. I mean, obviously, we have different programs and the racing's different, so we're not always with them. But even before the season starts, you have team meetings and the team launches and you're completely together. And then, yeah, races like this, and we have a race in the Vuelta and things like that, then always then we're together. And, yeah, when they win, it also feels like we've won. So, actually, it is really the staff also move around a lot and the coaches. So you do feel, yeah, integrated in both parts of it, yeah.
I noticed on social media and stuff during the Giro, there was a lot of support from the women for Tom Dumoulin. And I guess here you've had Barguil and Michael Matthews. Yeah. Is it reciprocated, do you feel that support goes the other way as well?
Yeah, definitely, I think so, yeah. Yeah, when we were watching the Giro and things like, yeah, these stage wins, it is really exciting for us and you do feel like a part of it. But then on the other end, yeah, when we have successes also, yeah, we won a stage of the Giro as well, and then that, and you do feel the support come the other way, which is nice. And after my accident as well, yeah, even today now all the staff are coming up and yeah, asking how you are, and yeah, and they came to visit me in hospital, so yeah, it's a nice feeling, yeah.
I think I'm seeing that integration in action. Michael Matthews has just entered your camper van.
Yeah, I think, yeah, the women have obviously already done the time trial course today, so I think also they can maybe give him a few tips. And yeah, I think it's quite, you can see that it's quite a casual relationship. It's quite chill between the two teams, yeah.
Well, I'll let you go off and maybe pick his brains as well and have a chat to him. But thanks very much and best of luck. So that was a rather remarkable story of Molly Weaver, her awful crash and recovery and comeback and setback at La Course. But she's back, and as I said earlier, I met her at Marseille Airport flying out after La Course, and she was there with some teammates. And, you know, just, I think, enjoying being back and looking forward, as I said, to Ride London Classique and the prize purse that was on offer there, which she won with Corinne Rivera, obviously winning there. And she's part of a great team. She mentioned that, you know, talked a little bit about how integrated the two men's and women's teams are at Sunweb, perhaps more so than any other team. And it was really nice to see that at La Course, just the coming and going of the male and female riders. And we see it on social media as well, the men and women supporting each other, which is nice. And yeah, they're a great example, I think, Sunweb. And in terms of results as well, I mean, what a season they're having. Incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to work, whatever they're doing across the team. And I always look at happy teams who are successful teams and you wonder, it's a bit chicken and egg really, but Sunweb seem to have it right. Obviously winning helps an awful lot with that, but I really do think that, you say example, I think they've absolutely set the example of how we could, I hesitate to say should, but certainly how we could see a sponsor integrating the male and female teams and doing it with such a wonderful parity and not just giving lip service to that, but, you know, the riders themselves, they treat each other as colleagues. That's how it looks from the outside anyway. If it's not conducive to success in the sense that maybe that's not what's creating it, it certainly doesn't harm in any way whatsoever. And I think that's great.
And as you said, it just happens through, you know, going on training camps together and things like that.
It's not rocket science.
They know each other. Yeah, no, absolutely. A little update on another crash victim. Claudia Creti was involved in a terrible crash at the Giro Rosa and was in a coma for a while. I don't know if we know how she's going to recover, but she's certainly out of the coma and she's returned home to Brescia, where she will continue her slow recovery and we'll await updates on her condition. But the news is at least more positive than it was a few weeks ago. So that's good. Best of luck to her.
Yeah.
So that's all for this month, I think, Orla. We've got lots to come up. I mentioned Robin Morton interview. We've got other longer interviews to play in future months. We want to be joined by a few guests as well. We've got a few people in mind, haven't we?
We do indeed.
We do indeed. Anyway, that's all for this month. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Richard.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.